And I think that subject will be inspirational, even though the tone may continue to be a bit academic. I'm not able to switch gears that easily on weekends, because I usually don't do this on weekends. But if this is what all of you wouldn't mind listening to for a while, or then thinking about, let's begin. I've organized this around sort of three headings. And there are some background matters that we need to put into perspective regarding his life, what he did, so forth. And secondly, we should say something about his achievement, why he is known. And then thirdly, and we'll spend most of our time on this, what is now referred to as spirituality, his spirituality. So the easiest way for Lutherans, I think, to get into the orientation of Augustine is to recall that Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. He was trained in Augustinian spiritual practices. He lived in a monastery until the time of the Reformation, which was Augustinian in its orientation, which read Augustine's Confessions. He knew these things by heart. He meditated on the words of St. Augustine, and Augustine is quoted throughout Martin Luther's writings. That Luther was an Augustinian and remained an Augustinian, and for us to look at Augustine is to look to somebody who is a father of the Lutheran tradition. He was born in 354 in northern Africa. His mother was the famous Monica. His father was named Patricius. His father is described in the literature as a pagan, meaning a non-Christian. There was a big battle between, not a battle, conflict, perennial conflict between mother and father regarding the orientation of the son. And some psychologists have said that that Monica played upon the boy, Augustine, and got some of the things from the boy which she was not able to get from her husband. Devotion, singleness, I mean, kind of sympathetic attitude toward her own religious sensitivities. But Augustine was a boy. When he writes the Confessions, he talks about the sinning that he did as an adolescent. The sin that stands out, the big sin that is referred to in the early books of the Confessions, is taking of fruit from a pear tree. Now, most of us wouldn't, I guess most of us have done that at one time or another, pull an apple from a tree when we didn't own the tree. This was a big thing for him, and he worried about it, he thought about it. Why would it be such a sin? Well, in later life, as he looked back, it was because he had taken something that hadn't been given to him. Had he been given this, it would have been all right. But it was a matter of snatching at something that was not his that bothered him. And it's similar to the fall into sin of Adam and Eve, you know, eating from the fruit of the tree of tree of knowledge when they were told not to do that. He wouldn't want to say wild, but he enjoyed life as a young man, enjoyed women. He lived with at least one woman for a while, probably more, had at least one child by this woman. His mother was upset by this, always followed him around. She was just always within stone's throw of where he was admonishing him to straighten out his ways, become a Christian. All this time he was going through tremendous intellectual turmoil. He was a kind of devotee of one philosophical position after another. He was very much committed to the viewpoint of the Manichaeans for a while. And the Manichaeans were folks like Gnostics today, where there was a clear separation between good and evil, between light and dark. The world was divided up between these polar forces, the forces of the devil, the forces of God, and there was big warfare going on between them, and you could clearly distinguish right from wrong. There were children of light, there were children of darkness, and the goal was to to become a child of light and be sort of pulled up out of the mess of things into the eternal world. And that he liked very much for a while, and he found certain flaws with it. And then he became a Platonist, a Neoplatonist, the follower of the teachings of Plotinus. And that, we can't get into all these kinds of things on Sunday morning, but that was a variation of the Manichaean position. He found certain fault with that as well. Now, it was when he was listening to the sermons of Ambrose in the city of Milan in northern Italy that he felt his heart strangely moved. His mother had been pursuing him around the Mediterranean world, and he went into a garden, and as he was in this garden, there were some children kind of playing nearby, and one of them said, you know, take up and read, tello lege, take up and read. The scholars have now said that they were playing a game, and it sounded like take up and read, but they were playing some other kind of game that children played in those days, and he thought it meant take up and read, but whatever, however, you know, you account for this. He picked, he had his Bible with him, his New Testament, Christian scriptures, and he opened it. There's a long tradition of this kind of thing in medieval times where people will open the Bible to a particular verse and then read it and think that it's divinely inspired. That still goes on in the mid-20th century, get some people into trouble. The words on which his eyes fell were the following from the epistle of St. Paul, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness and all those things, concupiscence and all this kind of stuff that he was mixed up in, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provisions for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Make no provisions for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Well, those were the words of his conversion. And he became converted to Christianity. The only decision he made at that point was to become a better teacher of rhetoric. He had been teaching rhetoric up to that time. It was a major event in his life, and yet it wasn't really catastrophic. And he then told his mother what had happened. His mother rejoiced. Shortly thereafter, his mother died. And shortly thereafter that, Augustine becomes more and more of a church person. He eventually becomes the a bishop. He's writing letters all around to various churches. He's involved in ecclesiastical work. And he is regarded, in retrospect, as probably the greatest of the church fathers, the most influential of all the church fathers. Some people say that he is the father of Christendom. Not the father of Christianity, maybe, or not the father of the faith. We'd have to go into the Bible to find the sources of the Christian faith. But the father of Christendom, meaning that it was through his work that Christian aspirations became institutionalized. The church came into being in the kind of fullness that we have. The theology came into being, that the organizational aspects of all of it, or the link between the Christian faith and Western culture was sort of cemented by the work of St. Augustine. Now, that's about as much as I want to say as in terms of kind of historical background. I want to talk very specifically about I think the best, outside the Bible, of course, the best book ever written, and I didn't bring a copy of it with me, and there doesn't seem to be one in the library. There may be, but I couldn't find it. So I have to do this sort of from memory this morning. The Confessions of St. Augustine. The Confessions contains about 14 chapters. It's a chronicle of Augustine's life, 14 books. It's a chronicle of Augustine's life, where he tells the event of the pear tree incident. He talks about the concubine, talks about his life in Carthage, his role as a teacher of rhetoric, many, many references to his mother, Monica. People who have read it carefully say that he discloses very much about himself. In particular, he had some kind of problem with his mouth, had toothaches a lot. At one point when God makes himself known to Augustine, he says, and at that point thou didst plague me with a toothache. And some Freudian kind of analysts have gone through all this, and because of the close relationship between between Augustine and his mother have come up with some rather interesting interpretations of what went on. Significantly, I think, the narrative part of the confession ends, the portion where Augustine is telling his life story, the narrative part ends after Augustine's mother dies and is buried. There are no more events. It's as though that was the end of his life. Or maybe that's too much to say. But in the next chapters, after he finishes the historical chronicle, the autobiographical recollecting of events in his life, the next chapters deal with concepts, with time, with memory, and with creation. Those are the three major concepts to which he devoted his reflection. I don't know what that says. You know, that his life ended, the events in his life didn't need to be recounted after his mother died. See, I keep doing these kind of university things. I'm going to do it again here. But somebody said that the difference between Sigmund Freud and the psychoanalyst C.G. Jung was that Sigmund Freud's mother lived until she was about 95 and had a kind of overpowering effect upon her son. And now that's the explanation of the difference. The difference is that C.G. Jung was much more open to kind of archetypal realities, to the presence of the archetypes, to primordial things, to realities in dreams, to things like mother figures. And this is Christine Downing who suggested this, that had Freud's mother died a little earlier, he may have been more open to realities like time, memory, and creation, to archetypal things than he was. I don't know, that's something to reflect on, but it does show. Now, I'm kind of playing around with this one today. I mean, playing with it, not playing around with it, playing with it, because there is a very direct connection between the figure of Monica in early medieval literature and the rise of interest in Mary. Monica is a kind of model for Mary. And I think that at times the two became the same for Augustine. I think there was a kind of fusion between Mother Monica and the Virgin Mary and Mother Church. And he refers to the church as our mother. Very interesting to me that he can refer to church as our mother, and he becomes the greatest of the church fathers, and yet only had one child, as far as we know, was not able to be a father after the conversion. He practiced celibacy in order to be a church father, and the one child that he did have was illegitimate, an illegitimate son, at least as it was viewed in retrospect. I want to say a couple of things here about how he patterned the interior life. And I'm not quite sure what the starting point is. I guess we start with his understanding of God. The other day I was suggesting or recalling that Augustine referred to God as the life of the life of my soul. And that's a definition that comes in one of the books of the Confessions after he asks the following kinds of questions. I said the other day that he goes around the universe and asks the stars if they made him, and the stars say, no, they are made. Planets are made. They have not made him. They have not created him, but they are themselves creations. He sets up another kind of inquiry which leads him to give description to God, and it comes out of his sense of beauty. The Confessions is full of references, allusions to beauty, to sensitivity. This line, "O beauty so ancient and so new," that one finds in Dante, was original with Augustine in the Confessions. Beauty that is ancient and new. Thomas Merton has taken off on that line, and is interpreted it as that beauty has two kind of components. It has a sense of being rooted deeply in reality. It also has a sense of freshness or innovation. And Merton has said that that's what the faith ought to be as well. Faith ought to have a component of rootedness. You know, it stands someplace. It's present there in permanence. It's reliable. It's stable. at the same time fresh all the time, always fresh, innovative, open to novelty, and it can become each of these because it also has the other side. It can be novel and innovative because it stands someplace, it can be sure of itself and can be open to change and to novelty, innovation. Well, Augustine has this line about beauty so ancient and so new, and he inquires of beauty about God. I think that's a nice way to do it, rather than of truth or of goodness. Those are okay too, but he inquires of beauty, and he asks things, these kinds of questions. If I had the text here, I could read it, and it's much more beautiful that way than to try to paraphrase it this way. But he asks of fragrance. He says, fragrance, are you God? When I love my God, is it that I love fragrance? And then he says, no. He said, is it, when I love God, is it that I love stillness? And stillness responds, no, it's not stillness. And then he goes on with a whole series of things like this, fragrance, stillness, order, design. Is it design that I worship when I worship God? And the answer that design gives back to him is no, it's not design. And then he comes to the conclusion that when he worships God, it is something within himself that he loves. When I love my God, it is something within myself that I love. And then he goes on to say, it's something in myself that I want to love. And then when he discovers that, he goes back and he asks the question of fragrance and stillness and beauty and harmony, the same kinds of questions, and the answer is yes. When I love my God, is it fragrance that I love? And after he's got it set out, I mean, he's got the priorities properly established, then fragrance can say yes. It is fragrance. It is beauty. It is stillness. It is harmony. It is order. It is all of these things because they are rooted in this reality of God. And then he has a wonderful couple of paragraphs about where he talks about beauty, and he says, I have come to love you late. I've come to love you late. It was that as though these realities were always there, but he had not come to perceive the nature of them early enough in his life. But that didn't spoil them. They were still there. They wait for him. That he doesn't have control over those things. And later in life, he comes to perceive them for what they are. But then here comes the catch. But then he recognizes that is he is the one who is being perceived. There's a wonderful line from when Richard Rogers died. There was an obituary someplace that I noted where it said, I don't know what Richard Rogers has to do with Augustine, but we'll make this connection, where it was said that he lived, he loved, and he understood. That's all he wanted anybody to say about him after he died. He lived and he loved and he understood. Now, Augustine would like all of that, particularly the second one, he loved, because life is primarily a matter of loving and getting loves sorted out and loving the right kinds of things and loving oneself properly and loving God properly. But he would always turn around the other way. He lived, he loved, and he understood, but he was loved and he was understood. And like the kind of thing that St. Francis does with verbs, you turn them back the other way. And it was not so much that he perceived God, but in perceiving God, he recognized that he was perceived. In loving God, what he really came to know was that he was love. He was loved. He was the object of love. So he goes on. There are a number of descriptions or definitions. They're not really definitions. They're not very technical descriptions of God. The one that I cited the other day, that God is the life of my soul. But he has another one in the context that we're working with this morning, where he says, God is he. I think it could be she too, he or she, or the one. God is the one who is nearer to me than I am to myself. The one who is nearer to me than I am to myself. I know what Herb Brokering can do with that, because he's talking about immediacy. Immediacy over against perspective. And the reality of God is so close to him that he doesn't perceive it. Because the way perception would work is you have to have some kind of distance between the subject and the object. But this is so close, more immediate to him than he is to himself, more immediate to his soul than his awareness of soul is immediate to soul. Can't give me the good illustrations of that. And that's about the best anyone can do. But I've been thinking about that phrase. I remember when this illustration lacks a little, but when John F. Kennedy was shot, Jacqueline Kennedy said, "Oh God," immediately, "Oh God." And when something happens that is really a shocker, you don't even have time to think, that word comes out very, very often. That's the sort of thing. I mean, he's more eloquent on that one than the illustration. There's another, only other example I can think of that comes anywhere close to the kind of truth that Augustine is conveying here, is comes from Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, where Thomas Aquinas gives several proofs for the existence of God. And these are the traditional kinds of proofs. The proof that how could the things that we see around us seem to be made, they're created, there are effects and there are causes. Now, he says if things are effects, then there must be causes. And a thing is either an effect or a cause or both. But if you're going to understand the world that way, your mind works itself back to recognizing the reality of a first cause. And then he says, and all men understand this to be God. The first cause is God. I heard that when I was a boy, when somebody said to me, well, look at the universe, look at the world, look how orderly it is. How could this ever be unless there were a mind or a God who created it? And you'd say, well, that's foolproof. I mean, that's very convicting. But I'm suggesting two things here. First of all, those are kind of traditional proofs for the existence of God. But the testimony that Thomas Aquinas really believed in was a sort of Augustinian testimony. God is nearer to us than we are to ourselves. And he puts the question this way. It's a long sentence that I can't see any more simply than I'm saying it. He says, how can you discount the, well, cognitive validity of the words that are there, but how can you discount the power, the force, the testimony of the confidence that you feel when your life is, when your being is threatened by non-being? How can you discount the cognitive validity of the confidence you feel when your being is threatened by non-being? What I think he means by that is that why do we all try all the time? Why do we get up in the morning and aspire toward things? See, all of us would know, if we look at it kind of empirically, that things are going to run out for us. It's downhill. Being is threatened by non-being. Non-being seems to win. Death overtakes us. The aging process can overtake us. There are all kinds of negatives. If you line up negatives and positive, well, you get conflicting evidence, but belief in God isn't based on those kinds of things, according to Aquinas. It's prior to all of that. There's interest, there's desire, there's will, there's wish, there's aspiration, there's intention. And the Thomistic philosophers refer to this as being precognitive, prior to thought, prior to reflection. And they'll even say that nobody reasons his way to an awareness of God. It's prior to the reasoning about it. What the reasoning might do is to give you clarity about what it is you believe in, but you can't reason from premises to conclusions and say, therefore, there is a God. That doesn't, nobody ever comes to it that way, really. In fact, these Thomistic philosophers say that you believe in it because you want to, because it's in there. And because, as Augustine said, when you believe in God, it is something within yourself that you want to believe in. Nearer to us than we are to ourselves. So the confessions, Augustine's confessions, is a kind of record of the dialogue he has with this interior being. Now, what amazes him, that the great miracle for him is that the creator of the universe, the one who set the whole thing going and sustains it, is also an interior reality, someone who speaks to the soul, the life of the life of one's soul. There aren't two gods, not the God who created the world and the God who is interior, but it's the same God who is creator of the world and also the life of the life of one's soul. So for Augustine, the way to come to know God is through self-knowledge, through disciplined self-knowledge. That's why Augustine is regarded as the founder of the Western contemplative tradition, Because that's what contemplation is. And that's what we do all the time. You know, reflect on ourselves, muse on ourselves, think about thoughts, think about aspirations. Prayer has a very important place in all of this, because prayer and contemplation are almost the same. So Augustine, in coming to know himself, let me say another thing before we get into that, that persons who do not love God, see, I was about to say do not believe in God, but belief for him is not as important as love. People who do not love God may be people who don't know themselves very well. That's stretching things a little bit, but who have not yet come to an adequate love of themselves. I don't want to go too far at that, because there's some things wrong with that kind of implication, but it's worth mentioning. Now, Augustine then has this nice phrase in one of his writings that, do not go abroad, he says, and do not go outside of yourselves, but turn within, for in the inner person dwells truth. Meaning that you don't have to go out and try to line up the evidence, do statistical studies of things, learn how to reason in the most careful way from on the basis of observation or logical sequences, but turn within. In the inner person dwells truth. When I think of Augustine in this connection, I think of that of the story of the rabbi. No, it's not a rabbi. It's a rabbinic tale of a man who had a dream many nights in a row that if he were to travel to the king's castle in the capital city of his country, he would find there a great treasure that had been set aside for him. And all he was supposed to do was to appear at the gate of the king's castle. Well, he wasn't one to be taken by dreams, but since the same dream appeared so many times, he followed it and went there, and took him a long time. This was before travel was easy. When he arrived at this place, he didn't know what to do next. He came up to the gate, nothing happened. So he walked around and around the hill, the walls of the castle, trying not to be conspicuous. But after a while, he did become noticed by the guards. And one of the guards came over to him and asked him what he was up to. And he said, I'm really embarrassed. He said, I'll leave here, but I want to tell you why I'm here. He said, I just had this dream that if I were to come here, I would receive this wonderful treasure. And but he said, now that I've told you that, I mean no harm, and I'm ready to go back home. Well, the guard at the castle gate said that that's not a very strange dream. He said, I've been having a dream night after night, that there's a man who lives out in one of the towns in the far reaches of the kingdom who has a hidden treasure buried beneath the floor in his parlor, two paces behind the stove. I just told him that, and the man put the two things together, went back home, lifted up the floorboards in his own house, two paces behind the stove in his parlor, and he found this treasure that had been there the entire time. That's similar to the Augustine story. The Augustine account is that you can go all over the world, you can travel outside of yourself, you can go into foreign countries, you can do this and that, but the treasure always lies close at hand. But we don't know it. We sometimes don't know it until we've gone away, and then we need to come back. But the treasure is nearer to us than we are to ourselves. He became very aware, though, in this kind of introspective stance of his, as any of you have who engage in that, that the interior life is really chaotic. You can become victimized by it. You can get caught on feelings and on negative kinds of things. You can terrorize yourself if you engage in introspective awareness just day after day after day. So it became important for him to be able to sort out the various kinds of tendencies that come to play in the interior life. And what he tried to do was to give these things names. Now, the way he proceeded in that regard was to take the names that had been attached to Roman deities, you know, like Zeus and all the others, and he understood that the deities had been interiorized, the power of the deities had been interiorized. So all of that which the deities stood for could be recovered in one's own interior life. I don't have time to get into all that today, because that talks about how he's able to synthesize a Greek world and a Roman world with a Christian world. But along the way, as he came to to recognize the kinds of powers and habits and tendencies and dispositions that were within him, he came to understand that there were two very prominent kind of warring factions within his own soul. And he gave names to these things. And the first one was superbia. Superbia meaning pride. The tendency of the human being to try to achieve the goal by means of self-effort, by the resources that one has at one's disposal. That was superbia. And he saw that all around him. And you can see it all around us today. You know, people moving up and down ladders, trying to ascend, trying to get to some place. It was like that phrase that I gave some of you the other day from the monastery in Elmira, try to do something today that doesn't get you anywhere. And he saw that all around him. And you can see it all around us today. You know, people moving up and down ladders, trying to ascend, trying to get to some place. It was like that phrase that I gave some of you the other day from the monastery in Elmira, try to do something today that doesn't get you anywhere. Superbia is when you do something that is calculated to get you someplace. And over against that tendency, which he saw very prominent within himself, and it talks about how loves are directed. It's a kind of acquisitive love, where love is motivated by the object of love, by what love seeks to achieve. Over against that, he saw the power of humilitas, humility, which was self-emptying love, Greek word being kenosis. The verse is that though Christ was in the form of God, he did not count equality with God a thing to be snatched at or grasped, but emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. Now, Augustine understands that those two realities are present within his own soul, within his own heart, and they are at odds with each other all the time. And what he needs to do is to allow the power of humilitas to conquer the power of superbia. Now that's a kind of interesting, you know, problem. And at that point, he is woeful. He knows that he can't do it. And then he says that it isn't just that humilitas is not just power or tendency or habit or temperament over which he has control, but humilitas he refers to in terms of the mediator. He says there is a mediator between man and God. And it's at that point that he realizes that Christ is present in his soul. Christ is mediator between his self-knowledge and his awareness of God, or the way in which he is perceived by God. And it's at that point, I mean, now we're right in the heart of it, because it's at that point that he wishes, that he prays, that reality of God would become stronger, that the reality of God in that form would become incarnate in him, in the way in which, in the same, according to the same pattern in which God has become incarnate in the world. The example that I can give on this one is, again, comes from monastic life, where I've gone with some students, as I often do, to a monastery up near Big Sur. When we were leaving there, one of the students, a fellow named Curtis, who had never been in a place like that before, didn't know if he wanted to go, but was almost overwhelmed by the experience. And when we were leaving and checking out with the monks, thanking them for what they had given us, Curtis said to the abbot, he said I've loved this so much, he said, but I know that when I get back, I will fall. He said, I will not be able to maintain it. And he said, what shall I do? And the abbot said, well, Curtis, do you know how to pray? And Curtis said he hadn't prayed much. And so they had a two or three minutes on prayer, and it had to do with if thinking about what you would do if you talked to a friend that you respected a great deal. And the abbot said, just talk that way. Talk that way to God. You can be in a room by yourself. Talk to God as though God is a friend whom you respect a great deal. And Curtis said, I'll try that, but he said, that isn't enough. He said, that won't be enough. I won't be able to do that. And then the abbot said, I can quote him here, he said, I don't know what else to tell you, Curtis, except, he said, day by day, give formation to the life of God that is within you. Day by day, give formation to the life of God that is within you. Well, Curtis didn't ask any more questions at that point, and I don't know how Curtis is doing with that at the moment. I imagine that was that's as close to the heart of things as one can come. But this is what Augustine has in mind, that there is this kind of implicit life of God that is within us that needs to be formed. And the formation that it takes is modeled according to the pattern of humilitas, to the incarnation, so the incarnation of God in the world. But he can talk about several incarnations. See, there is the incarnation of God in Christ, where God becomes man, human in Christ. See, so much of Christianity is, I can say nothing more than that, and that's a terrible thing to say unless you have something more to offer, where God becomes incarnate of Christ, and the news of that is transmitted to the next generations. See, that wouldn't be enough for Augustine. It wouldn't be enough simply that we heard that at one time God became incarnate of Christ, in Jesus, and then the message of that is transmitted into future generations. I mean, that's wondrous and marvelous and a miracle and all of that, and he'd say wonderful things about it. But what really got to him was that the very thing that happened when God became incarnate in Jesus, in the form of Christ, was also occurring within his own soul. The formation of the life of God was occurring within. And there was, and that's where Thomas A Kempis gets that phrase, imitatio Christi, to be formed in the imitation of Christ. I'm near the end. I'm going to quit here early enough so it gives you a chance to respond. But there's just one little thing that follows upon that, and that's that Augustine looked to Christ not only to provide the example or the model of how the interior life was formed, but he also understood that the major events in his own life could be depicted in terms of the major events in the life of Christ. What I'm suggesting is that the passion story in which Christ participated, where God is not simply coming into the world but also dies on behalf of humanity, that passion story was reproduced, replicated in the interior life. That's what the heart, that is the story of the heart, the song of the heart. A kind of day-by-day dying to self and rising again. Or to say that in a slightly different way, it isn't simply that Christ, the incarnation of God in Jesus, was crucified, but it's also Christ, the formation of God in the soul. There's crucifixion there as well. There's resurrection there as well. When Luther talks about this day-by-day, dying to self and rising to the new life in God, it has to be a daily thing, not just once in a lifetime, but daily, because it describes the formation of the the loves of the human heart, the passions of the soul. Now, even from a historical point of view, what one would say here, if you're just writing this kind of thing for the Britannica, you're not doing it, or the World Book or something, not doing it in Holden Village, and for persons who are kind of committed to this point of view, what really sort of gets to me and makes me I think the whole thing is marvelous, is that if Augustine hadn't been known at all as the founder of Christendom, he would have been known as the first person in the Western world, in fact in the Western or Eastern worlds, to write an autobiography. He is the first autobiographer. There are previous autobiographical accounts. I have a student down in Santa Barbara who's identified all of these prior to the time of Augustine. Cicero does some of that, and there are a lot of other people who did bits of that. Expressed pieces of their life in autobiographical form. But Augustine was the only one to do the whole thing. Now that is significant. But what is even more significant is that Christians from that time forward have taken the events that Augustine talks about in his own life as being paradigmatic for the rest of us, because there is a correspondence between the events in Augustine's life and the events in the life of Christ. It didn't have to come out that way, but this is where we get the narratives. It's also where we get the basis for pilgrimage, that life can be depicted as a pilgrimage, where you move from a source to a destination through a series of trials. And the application of the story of Christ, the story of Jesus of Nazareth, as the way of reading one's own interior history, was first composed by St. Augustine. I said I was done. I do this every time. I'm not quite finished. Because Augustine sort of believed, I think, that most people know the goal, he said. Most people know the goal. I mean, you know that if you know yourself well, you know the goal. What is the goal? The best he could say was that the goal is union with God, to be at one with God. Now, he said that in a lot of different ways. He talked about knowing God and enjoying him forever. He talked about the glad day when one would perceive, when one would see God face to face. And what he thought was so wonderful about that, I mean, it's so wonderful you can hardly speak about it, is that then he would see the one who has been perceiving him, the one who has seen him, the one by whom he is seen, would become revealed to him. And he thought that most people, you know, if they knew themselves well, would come to an awareness of the goal and could agree on what the goal is, the goal being union with God, but they didn't know the way. And the way had to be revealed. You couldn't come to a knowledge of the way on your own. It would be too difficult to find. And the way is the way of humilitas. And humilitas, for Martin Luther, becomes translated as justification by grace through faith. The same kind of Christ-like pattern is, Luther has to rediscover that, because that has been lost for a couple of centuries in late medieval history for a lot of reasons that one could give. Now, let me do my own thing here just for 1 minute. I don't think, we've been talking here about the nature of Lutheranism and all those things across the last few days. I don't think that when Luther says that it's justification by grace through faith, I don't think he means that that's the goal. I think the goal is the same as it always has been. The goal is union with God. I think justification by grace through faith is the way. That's a translation of the pattern of humilitas. And I think why Lutheranism is a bit weak is that it has equated the way with the goal. It has taught the way as though the way were the goal, and has forgotten what the goal is sometimes. We don't hear very much about the goal. We hear very, very much more about the way. It's as though if we understand what the way is, that's as much as we need to know. That isn't as much as we need to know, not in an Augustinian world. Luther was as eloquent on way as any Christian has ever been, but I think for Luther, the goal was the same as the goal for Augustine. Well, I've said enough here this morning to, I guess we have about 10 minutes to respond if you want to do that. I'm really sorry that I don't have the confessions here, because I've taken about 50 minutes of talk here for something that would be much more eloquent if you could just simply hear a paragraph or two from the confessions. They're readily available everywhere. Now, Penguin Books has a new translation of it. And anyone want to say anything?
George MacDonald got some of this in Undoubtedly each day. It's been very helpful to me. You know, he must have been a student of ours. I read quite a bit of it. I just hadn't thought of that until you mentioned that.
Yeah. And I think he's as you can tell, I think he's an important figure.
What was his mother famous for?
His mother was famous for... his mother was a very fine woman, we could say. I mean, a very pious woman. Now, I can't see any flaw in her. She was persistent. She prayed for him. She wanted more for him than he would have settled for. But that's all. You know, she didn't write anything. Well, that's a lot. She didn't write anything anybody remembers. I think Ginny Witt was talking yesterday about models and metaphors for women. I didn't hear it. But I think Monica is an important model, medieval model, and it's out of that sensitivity to Mary grows. I can say a little bit more about Mary if you can take it. Mary can also be interiorized. That's how it comes about in the medieval times. You can talk about just as Mary was sort of the context or the womb or the environment out of which the historical life of Christ came, so also Mary refers to that kind of interior, gee, it's hard to talk this way, the interior reality through which God is formed within the soul. Again, all of these things that Augustine could talk about in exterior terms, God, Christ, Mary, the Passion story, were also present within the self. That's why it'd be possible to say that when one loves God, it is something of oneself that one also loves. He didn't believe you had to hate yourself, had to hate sin, and sin was kept you from realizing the goal. But it was really self-love and properly founded, properly established, that comes to awareness of the love of God. You got more there than you asked for.
Was Augustine an only child? Did that occur to other
children? No, actually, he was the only one.
Mm-hmm. Was Augustine exposed to the Eastern or Oriental monks somewhere along the line?
Well, through the that's right. The Syrian tradition, the Manichaeans, the mystery religions, the Orphic mysteries, all of those were part of his background, and he's significant historically because he reproduces so much of their thought, you know, as he tells about his own Odyssey. He was very, very intense. He thought everything through very, very carefully. He tried mysticism, a kind of Neoplatonic mysticism, and it worked for him. He almost thought that he was having a kind of mystic vision, but then he says, what do I do about this body? What do I do about the body? He couldn't get himself out of the flesh. And that's why that phrase that came to him from St. Paul, not in rioting, drunkenness, and all those things, put on the Lord Jesus Christ, make no provisions to fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Christianity appealed to him because it said that the body is real. Those other kinds of mystery religions where the Manichaean positions and so forth were talking about how it was possible to kind of extricate yourself from your body. And Christianity didn't say that. Christianity says that the reality of God is in the body. You know, Christ is flesh, incarnate, and it's your body and the resurrected body. Pardon?
I think it was in Wisdom of Solomon that said, God created man in the image of his righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that if perhaps what we're seeking is God's image in ourselves, does this come anywhere near?
That's close. Yeah, that's what it is. But in seeking God's image in oneself is also to seek one's truest self.
What was that last thing?
Seek one's truest self. Yes.
Would you repeat that phrase that the
Arius
said to the
Arius? Who said this?
When you took the student
to the... Oh, yeah. He said, he referred, monks get on first name basis fast. You know, they don't say Mr. Caps or anything like that. They call you Walter right off. He said, Curtis. He said, Curtis, day by day, give formation to the life of God that is within you. Now, with my Lutheran sensitivities, I would say something like, well, how can I ever do that? But you learn how to do that. It's by the grace of God that one gives formation to the life of God that is within you. We were talking the other day about eyes, and I've been talking to Herb Brokering about that. One of the great things of being here is being with Herb and Lois Brokering these days. But I tend to watch how people respond to statements. And Curtis didn't look dumbfounded when the abbot said that. Curtis had, as he told us, no training at all in Sunday things, church, religious life. When the abbot said that to him, it was like, okay, I mean, I've got that. He didn't understand it completely. But he didn't have to say, how do I do that? It just, those are the kinds of things like, you know, that where you speak from the world that is prior to reflection, where you're not saying things that come out of kind of analysis, kind of an analytical mode. It just zap almost, just immediate. And Curtis, I rode back in the car with him. He was angelic for a while. Yeah, I guess he may still be. I don't know. I don't think anybody can say anything. You know, hardly anyone can say this more profound than that. What are we to do? Day by day, give formation to the life of God that is within you, because that's to bring Christ to birth. And Johann Tauler, always Luther is in my mind when I talk about these things. But Tauler's writings instructed Luther. Tauler said there are three incarnations. There are three births of Christ. There's the birth of Christ that comes in the context of the Trinity, where the Son is begotten of the Father. The other day I said proceeds from the Father. That's really the word that is used for Holy Spirit. But the Son is begotten of the Father before the worlds. We had some of that on the slides over there in the village center today. Before all worlds, the Son was begotten of the Father. Now that can be distinguished from the birth, from the incarnation of God in the figure of Jesus of Nazareth. You can distinguish that. You can also put them together. But Tauler said that the third birth is the birth of Christ in the soul, the formation of God in the human heart. And you can add that Christianity is impoverished if it only has one of those or two of those, or if it settles for the third, it doesn't keep the others. So it gets back to the whole idea about harmony and balance. Well, Augustine wanted all of those. He thought about creation. He thought about time, pre-time. He thought about the life of Christ, life of Jesus of Nazareth. And he found that there was this wonderful correspondence between all of these births, and that he was involved, somehow he as one individual was involved in that ongoing world drama. And that was almost unfathomable for him. And I think it's for that reason that he, instead of talking about this stuff philosophically, he gets into the language of beauty and fragrance. Just smells so good, just feels so right, just gets to him. And the Buddhists say that, I'll mess it all up here now by talking about the Buddhists, but the Buddhists will say, you know, that the meaning of life is to be found in this flower. Now, Augustine, I think, could say that the meaning of life is to be found in this rose. The rose becomes a very important medieval image. If you could understand all the things that are necessary to have that kind of rose right here, you would understand the meaning of life. And that's why rose, and the rose is kind of a symbol for Mary, for Mother, for Monica, for the kind of the womb out of which the life of Christ is formed. Well, I'm starting to repeat myself now. I think maybe it's time to quit.
Is there some substance to the idea that all can come to that awareness to the same extent, or that some people will come to an awareness of some different levels of understanding?
I don't know. I'm really not clear about that. I guess I think that it's something like being kind of tone deaf in music. You know, some people can't hear it. But I don't want to think that. I want to think that all, that it's available to everybody. But there must be degrees of perception. I don't know. I don't think it's based on intelligence. You know, I know that, I'm sure at this point now, that it doesn't matter. I mean, the smartest people aren't the ones who recognize most acutely that they are being perceived by God. It isn't based on IQ, but it must be conditioned to a certain extent by one's ability or one's willingness to let one's sensitivities be cultivated. And I think that it might be possible to say that some people are ahead of others in that regard. I know that's true because the next thing they do in the Middle Ages is to talk about the various stages of development, and they don't put, you know, qualitative distinctions on this. They don't say that some people, because they're further along, they're better people than the others. But they say things, for example, that once one becomes aware of the reality of God within, it's a very joyous time for quite a while. And the people seem to be happy, and they kind of want to talk about it. And there's another kind of a nosedive thing that comes along later. And then there's a, it's a constant kind of oscillation up and down, and there may be a period of several months where it's a dry period, where the life of God doesn't seem to be very vibrant, vital. There's a long tradition in medieval literature based on interpretation of Jesus' words that in my Father's house are many rooms, or many mansions, and you kind of move from room to room, and Christians are not all in the same room at the same time. Teresa of Avila has a book called Interior Mansions, where she attempts to sort of chronicle a kind of paradigmatic account of interior pilgrimage. And there's consensus on this.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the word seeking isn't important in this area, that if we seek the joy and the results and the pleasures and the fulfillment can come from the seeking, and that the seeking is not necessarily at a particular level. Uh-huh. Seeking is sometimes more important than the goal itself.
Yeah. I think what Augustine would say about seeking is that it appears to be seeking, but it's been prompted by something that is there prior to the seeking. One is motivated to seek.
Something motivated to seek. Mm-hmm.
And that's why he can have this kind of interior stability even when he doesn't find on a certain day, because he has confidence in that power that motivated him to seek. Mm-hmm. Seek and you shall surely find, but maybe not today.
Well, I was taking it from seek ye first, and I was emphasizing
that's
the
right.
word seek. Mm-hmm. If that's the first thing to do, seek. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that meditation is part of the process?
Oh, sure. I don't see. It depends what you mean by meditation, maybe. But if we're talking about prayer, I don't see how that can. I don't see how the process can begin without that, or ever. I don't know how anybody could ever participate in. But prayer could be rather inclusive. It can mean meditation could mean that you can meditate riding on a bus and walking around. It doesn't always have to be formal prayer, formal meditation. On the other hand, those things help. Regular meditation times. The monks have learned that if you don't do it, you know, if you don't set it into your schedule, you may not get to it that day, and if you don't get to it that day, it gets harder to get to the next day. And
one of the many things that goes to my mind is that in our liturgical life in the church, we go so fast, and we cover the same items in some kind of a seriated way, as though we must cover most of them, at least a high percentage. I once did the Animus Dei for an hour, mm-hmm. and it was all there.
Sure.
And the unity, everything that precedes, the Lamb of God, and what Lamb is, mm-hmm. and this naming of the Lamb, and this coming and bowing and being with the Lamb, and up to getting this peace with the Lamb, and having this peace of the Lamb in you. That's it. It's all there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on a busy Sunday, just skip that. Or why not on a busy Sunday just have that?
Yeah.
I mean, this flexibility is somehow these things end to end instead of into each other is one of the pictures that comes to my mind. There are so many ways to see what is going on, and to print it out and to keep that printed form for 17 years in a row till we get the next new way to print out. Can't help much toward contemplation and meditation and reflection and reviewing and interiorizing. And I wanted to say too that when Dave Rubik and I were together about 2 years ago, he said, when you write this cantata, remember the people in Africa. He got very emotional. And remember my friends in India. I remember, and he got very emotional. He said, I don't know how you can do it except through the passion of Jesus. And he said, his compassion is my compassion. And that is the only way to say it that I know. So he was interiorizing the this whole passion of our Lord inside his own compassionate spirit and asked for that.
I just want to add one thing to that, and then we really have to quit. I've been suggesting in this other course, kind of the sessions that I've been teaching, that there's a conflict within the church at the moment between the dispositions of action and contemplation. Now, one way to keep that straight and to provide a synthesis is in the way that Herb suggested. You can say, for example, that the passion story is not simply an event in which God in Christ participated, but the passion story describes the process through which our own souls are going, and that's the contemplative experience. But you can also say, Jürgen Moltmann says this, that the passion story is the process through which the world is passing. That's passion out there as well. The passion story as well. The very same story. Minority, poverty, all those things. Action and contemplation really do have their roots in the same kind of dynamic. And Christians have said that when you get to the heart of that dynamic, you probably can't explain it, but you can tell a story, and the story is about death and resurrection. That's as much as I can do this time. Let's do whatever we do next. Thank you very much for your attention and the time you've given me.